This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. October 7th, 2021 marked the 20th anniversary of the start of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. The Wall Street Journal reports that a strange quiet has fallen across the nation since U.S. ground troops withdrew. The capital, Kabul, faces the prospect of blackouts because the Taliban is unable to pay electricity bills in an effort to isolate the regime that it fought and then partnered with. The U.S. and NATO nations have imposed sanctions on the Taliban, which critics say will ultimately hurt ordinary Afghans. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has just announced it will begin prosecuting war crimes in Afghanistan, but only against the Taliban and the Islamic State. The U.S., which just admitted to killing a family of civilians, including seven children, will be mysteriously exempt from prosecution. My guest is John Sifton, Asia Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch. He recently wrote an article for Foreign Policy in Focus titled "Averting Afghanistan's Economic and Food Crises." Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you.
Before we get to the ICC story, let's talk about the sanctions issue and the fact that, as I mentioned, Kabul might be out of power because the Taliban doesn't have money. What are the sanctions that the U.S. is aiming at the Taliban, and how does it expect that that would actually cripple the Taliban and not ordinary Afghans?
The sanctions issue is actually a little bit more complicated than widely understood. There are not new sanctions on the Taliban. No sanctions were imposed at the end of the war. Sanctions which have existed previously and were imposed first in 1998 in response to the 1998 embassy bombings in Africa. They were expanded in subsequent years, but they're basically counterterrorism-related sanctions, not human rights-related. But they still exist, and the Taliban, as the government, is still under the sanctions regime that was created back then, just like it was in the last 2 years of its being in power in the late 90s. So those sanctions are not like typical ones that go against particular people so much as prohibit transactions that certain government entities would take part in, the most important of which is the Kabul-based Central Bank of Afghanistan, which is a vital financial institution for processing in and out of the country. So unless some situation can be fixed to allow that bank to function again, these sanctions, these old sanctions, are going to create a lot of problems for ordinary Afghans.
So the sanctions themselves, have they in and of themselves actually had any impact on anything? I mean, when we think about sanctions in general, they've supposed to be the sort of nonviolent tool of leverage and pressure. If these are old sanctions, what were they doing?
Well, look, I think they were counterterrorism sanctions back then. And the idea was that the Taliban should not be able to take part in the international economy and send money over international wires and things like that. But all of that was kind of irrelevant because the Taliban back in the late 1990s and for much of the last few years has relied on a different way of moving its money, not using banks, you know, as much. But now, since they took over the government and are the de facto authorities, they have a power which is quite different. They now control the Central Bank of Afghanistan, which has U.S. dollar accounts in it that private banks in Kabul need to access in order to pay salaries. And, you know, if I send somebody money, Western Union wants to be able to give out that money in dollars or local currency. But it can't do that if the Central Bank doesn't have any dollars or local currency to give to them. So it creates a liquidity crisis, a financial crisis. And the Taliban, for their part, are not, you know, going to be able to govern as a government if something isn't changed with this process down the line. There's also an issue that the central bank has assets in overseas. They have $10 billion approximately in foreign currency reserves held primarily in New York at the New York Federal Reserve, and not having access to that money makes it impossible for them to settle transactions, even ones that don't benefit them.
Right. I mean,
so it creates a lot of problems.
It's interesting if the U.S. partnered with the Taliban to withdraw forces, right? It was in secret talks with the Taliban for years to withdraw forces, and to now de facto cripple this entity, it's setting it up for failure.
Well, that's why I think everybody is now in agreement that something needs to be done. Now, the anxiety is about the Taliban's human rights record and commitments to counterterrorism down the line. And so there's an anxiety in Washington and in Brussels and in other donor countries to simply give the Taliban access to all of its assets, meaning $10 billion in an account at the New York Fed. It's a political problem as well as a economic problem. But that doesn't mean you can't sort out short-term fixes to fix the financial things. There are things that can be done to allow the central bank not to have all of the money, but you know, have enough to settle transactions, be able to let the United Nations move money into the country to pay staff, to pay salaries, and to allow the millions of Afghans who send money to Afghanistan to their relatives to be able to send money to their relatives. This is just banking crisis. This isn't like a major issue that it doesn't need to be one or the other sanctions.
Right.
It's more a question of carving out what are allowable transactions. That's a short-term fix that could be made very quickly if donor countries and the United States in particular decided to.
The G20 is currently meeting to discuss aid to Afghanistan. The United States under Joe Biden would like to offer humanitarian assistance to independent international organizations rather than directly to the Taliban. I suppose this is its way of saying, look, we are doing something about the fact that there is this humanitarian crisis, but is it enough?
No, it's not enough, and that's the problem. The Afghan economy for decades, for 100 years, has always relied on outside assistance to function. It doesn't have revenue sources significant to cover expenditures, public expenditures or anything. If the United States and others are uncomfortable paying money to Taliban entities, they will need to figure out alternative methodologies to support the sectors they want to focus on. So for instance, the health sector, education sector, large numbers of the employees are essentially government employees, civil servants. If they want those people to be paid, they're going to have to figure out a way to pay them that circumvents the Afghan government itself. And that's been done in some other places, Yemen, Venezuela. But it's not something that the UN is very good at when you elevate it to a grand scale. So it's one thing to give $40 million. Which in a humanitarian setting is actually very little. It's another thing to talk about the hundreds of millions of dollars in salary support that a functioning government needs to provide in order to keep the country from collapsing and keep its economy from collapsing. So, and then even if you figure out all that, you still got to get the money into the country, physically or electronically or both. And the UN is not well suited to that. That's what central banks are for, which is why I keep talking about central banks, because if you can't move the money, then it doesn't matter how much pledged humanitarian assistance or other support you give. It just doesn't matter, because at some point, somebody's got to send that money to Kabul electronically and physically, because some of the money has to be available for physical withdrawal. Also, the Taliban needs to be able to produce more of its own money, the local currency, which they don't currently have the capacity to do. Afghanistan's money is printed outside of the country. It used to be printed in Europe. And until the companies that do that are given licenses to do that again, to get around the sanctions issues, that's going to also create problems with cash shortages.
Let's talk about the other aspect of Afghanistan after the United States has withdrawn forces. The International Criminal Court has said that it is going to begin resuming investigations of war crimes in Afghanistan, because there doesn't seem to be much prospect for domestic justice system to work fairly. But it's exempting the United States, which of course is responsible for many, or potentially responsible for many crimes, including the latest one where it dropped a drone strike on a car that it said was aimed at the perpetrators of the airport bombing. And it turned out, and even admitted, that it basically killed a family, including seven children. So what does this mean for international justice?
Well, it was a terrible decision. I mean, make no mistake. The majority of war crimes and civilian casualties that have occurred over the last 20 years have been caused by the Taliban itself and Islamic State. But a growing number over the last 10 years were being caused by the Afghan government and U.S. forces and airstrikes. To decide to just take all those deaths off the table, it makes no sense. And even if you were going to do it, announcing it makes no sense. Generally, prosecutors don't signal what their focuses are. They just investigate. And it also just speaks badly of the court's credibility globally, that it's only focused on one party to the conflict and not the other. We understand the argument about scarce resources and focusing on something that, you know, is more current and less about accountability for the past. But it's inexcusable to just completely write off a whole set of abuses that were carried out. It's wrong to, I think, assume that it's all just about the US and the airstrikes and the CIA, because that's only part of it. It's also the previous Afghan government was extraordinarily brutal and engaged in torture and atrocities.
Right. These were many of them men who had war crimes in their past, who were guilty of war crimes even before they were essentially invited into the Afghan government by the then Bush administration, right? The U.S. crafted this government of many war criminals.
Yes. And that's the problem, the perennial problem with Afghanistan, is that people point fingers, they say these people are worse than those people. And it's really a waste of time to argue over who did more and who damaged the country more. They all did, including the Taliban. And that's why accountability needs to be even-handed, precisely for that reason. So that's why the ICC argument was so bad. The Taliban now is engaged in the business of governance, and some of the policies they have on women's rights, if they are implemented broadly, consistently across years, could result in degradations of women's rights that are so great that they might even amount to crimes against humanity. So, you know, we agree focusing on the Taliban and accountability is a good idea, but you've got to focus on the other things too.
Now, do you think that the ICC's response or its announcement that it wouldn't prosecute war crimes by the U.S. in Afghanistan might have been a response to what the Trump administration did during, the previous ICC prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, was basically sanctioned directly by the Trump administration?
It's more than that. I mean, the Trump administration was really aggressive and went off the rails, but clear, the Obama administration also pressed hard on the ICC, against the ICC, and was no friend of the ICC. The United States government writ large is not friendly with the ICC, which may have been part of what motivated this, but the prosecutor, I can't opine what the prosecutor's internal thinking was. He's citing scarcity of resources, but I can't opine what was really going on in his head. I just know that the result is not a good policy, and hopefully it can be revisited.
And this is Karim Khan, who has only been on the job for about 3 months. John, considering where Afghanistan is today with its, economists have essentially said that its economy is in free fall, the sanctions continue to prevent access to those funds that you were mentioning earlier, the central funds, and you have this Taliban regime in power. Do you worry that the Western world will once more forget about Afghanistan. I mean, it's basically whenever Afghanistan falls out of the news, the $8 dry up and it just becomes this afterthought and then rears its head again when a Western country is attacked with an attack linked back to Afghanistan.
Well, part of the reason we're here is because the world already forgot about Afghanistan twice, you know, in 1992, then in 1996, and then again, three times, in 2002 or so.
1992. Yeah. In fact, can you quickly, 1992 is during the Civil War, right after the Soviets withdrew.
In 1992, the Soviet-backed government collapsed and the country was plunged into civil war and nobody did anything about it. There was no negotiated settlement. And that civil war went on for years and destroyed huge portions of Kabul and the countryside of Afghanistan, and paved the way for the Taliban to take power in 1996 as the sort of peacemaker who, you know, beat everybody and then took over the country. And then, you know, during the period of the Taliban, you know, the United States and others, you know, they paid attention, they did, talked about human rights, but nobody actually did anything to, you know, change the Taliban's behavior or affect them or engage with them or anything. And then after the US invasion, 2002 or so, you know, the US government turned its attention to Iraq and, you know, they forgot about what was going on and they fashioned a political settlement with new non-Taliban actors, but didn't pay enough attention to what they were doing or the strategy of it. They did throw a lot of money at it, give them that, but they didn't give it a lot of brain power. And as a result, you know, 18 years more passed with, you know, failed institution building. And when the Taliban finally had its moment, its opportunity, the whole thing imploded like the house of cards it was, because nobody had been paying enough attention to the fact that it was a house of cards. So I am concerned that, you know, the world will forget. I think engagement is needed with the Taliban, bad as they are. They have an atrocious human rights record. But so does a lot of countries. So do a lot of countries.
And the US and NATO chose to work with the Taliban in its withdrawal. So it's sort of like it's made its bedfellows.
That was driven by necessity, but sure. Even if put aside necessity, it's just simple moral obligation that if you ignore the Taliban and pretend they don't exist and just cut them off and cut their bank, the Central Bank of Afghanistan, off from performing its basic fiduciary duties to the state, then you're actually making things worse than the Taliban itself. Because the Taliban are doing all these horrible things. They're like engaging in summary executions. They're persecuting people who associated with the former government. They're restricting the rights of women and girls and their employment opportunities and their education. But it's going to be even worse if the economy collapses and there's like mass famine.
Right.
So, you know, we have to engage one way or another. And the engagement is an opportunity for leverage to make, you know, demands of the Taliban. They say, look, you say, you've already said that you're committed to allowing women to study and work. Well, we're going to hold you to that. And we'll give you this money up front. But if you don't do better, you're not going to get more. You'll get more for more and less for less.
Well, John, as you and I are speaking, the European Union has announced a $1.15 billion in aid to, quote, stabilize the Afghanistan region. Imagine that this is just a Band-Aid, right?
It's a lot of money, but not enough, because what's needed more than the money itself, the money's needed, no doubt. But what's also needed is a solution to the economic restrictions that are strangling the economy. I mean, unless that's sorted out, it doesn't matter how much money you pledge, because how are you going to send it to Kabul? I mean, if you're paying salaries, paying doctors, buying medicine, buying textbooks, paying student teachers, the money needs to get from Brussels to Kabul electronically and to a lesser degree physically, because they'll run out of dollars if they don't get more, then it doesn't matter. If you can't figure that out, the pledge isn't going to have the impact you need it to have. We've seen these problems before with Syria, with Yemen, with Venezuela, where the issue isn't simply a humanitarian crisis that needs a humanitarian response. It's also, there's economic, financial system breakdowns that need to be addressed. And if they aren't, you exacerbate what's already a bad situation.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and shedding light on these issues. We'll post a link to your latest article on our website. Is hrw.org the best place to find out about your work?
Yes, hrw.org, or you can simply search HRW Afghanistan and it will direct you to the Afghanistan page.
And we'll link to that. Thank you so much, John, for your time here.
Thank you.
My guest has been John Sifton, Asia Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch, author of a recent article for Foreign Policy in Focus titled Averting Afghanistan's Economic and Food Crises. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.